Living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Welcome to the seventh episode of Chemical World.
I am Maggie Seldin, peer recovery coach for Mind Springs Health, here with you, as always, with my lovely co-host,
Kenna Crampton,
the wonderful membership director here at KDNK. I know she gets tired of telling you all that, but she did some amazing work with our fall membership drive here at KDNK. We're so happy to have met our goals, so just a big thank you to all our new and renewing members and listeners. And yeah, now it is officially October. The colors are turning and winter's coming.
Winter is coming and you can feel it in the air. You can feel that chill come in and things are just heating up politically and, you know, throughout the whole country. So, now more than ever, support for people in recovery is important. So we are happy to be doing what we're doing, and we're hoping that we can be there for some people. We're hoping we can be some comfort for y'all out there.
Absolutely. And I just want to make a little plug. If you aren't already following Chemical World on Facebook, we are there as well as Twitter and Instagram, posting at least weekly. And if you didn't catch it, I think last week I posted a little meme that says voting is harm reduction. Voting is really one of our only options, unfortunately, in the current system to really get out there and make our voice heard. So just really encouraging everyone to get out, make sure you're registered, and check out the candidates. There are a lot of amazing things going on actually locally this November. So we've got a lot of candidates here in Garfield County. So go and check that out.
Yeah, and I think just no matter where you are, your local government is where you can make the biggest difference. So, of course, it's important to vote for the president, but it's also important to keep an eye on what's going on in your community locally, because that's where you can really make the difference, feel the difference that you're making.
Definitely, and I think that the presidential campaign can feel a little overwhelming to people. So just knowing that there are important local elections happening, it's a great reason to register, even if you don't feel like you want to vote for some people. There are other voting things happening.
Yeah.
So, okay, just wanted to get that out of the way. We've got about a month left about 3 weeks now at this point,
yeah,
until elections, so we're definitely gearing up. But I thought today it would be nice to kind of digress from our pretty data-heavy shows that we've been doing and just kind of have a little more of a discussion, kind of your traditional podcast style, I suppose, just so you guys can learn a little bit more about Kenna and I and the path that has brought us into the public affairs production room today.
Yeah, I'm excited to visit all of this with you. Of course, I love talking about myself. No, but I think we're going to continue to have people on the show talking about their paths to recovery and their journeys, and we just thought it would be important to get that information about us out there to you all understand why we're here doing what we do. It's not just a job to us. It's a passion, and it's something that's really we hold dear to our hearts.
Yeah, getting the ball rolling by sharing our own recovery stories after our wonderful interview that we had here in September with Kath Adams and Patty Grace. We just feel like, yeah, the conversation is what it's all about, right? And I just wanted to say that I will be throwing some more little tidbits in that are all predominantly going to be from Johan Hari's Chasing the Scream, which I've been citing a lot on this podcast. But I just wanted to kind of put a disclaimer out before we start talking, because I'm going to say a lot of things, and they are all from Johan Hari's book. So these are not definitive facts, but if you are interested in learning more, I would encourage you to check out his book, and because everything I'll be saying is based on studies that he has researched. So, Kenna, I'm trying to think when our friendship really started. I remember going to your middle school graduation from Waldorf. So you were probably 13 then?
14.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I Yeah, I was 14 when I graduated from 8th grade at the Waldorf school. Yeah. And then that was kind of right when I started hanging out with one of our mutual friends a lot more. And that's kind of how you and I think, started hanging out.
Yeah, definitely. I was reflecting recently on a memory where that same mutual friend, we were on vacation together, and she said, when you come back, we're going to be hanging out in Kenna's attic all the time. And then that was exactly what happened. And so I was probably 12 at the time. And I know for me, that is also when I started becoming heavily involved with using drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. So 14, I was August of the year that I was 14. I had just turned 14. It was a month into it when my father died. And I was dating a guy, my first like serious real boyfriend at the time. And he was the one who introduced me to marijuana. so we started smoking pot a lot. And I kept saying, I'm not going to drink. And then right around 15 was when I started drinking. And then that went heavy right away.
So a couple things. First of all, I did not realize, and it's funny because we actually learn, even though we've known each other for so long, we learn a lot about each other in these conversations. And I didn't realize not only that you were that old when you lost your father, but that was right when I met you. Because I also remember seeing you at a Basalt Battle of the Bands.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that.
Was that in the summer? They do those in the summer usually, right? So
yeah, so that... That must have been the summer before my freshman year of high school.
Okay.
Yeah, which I guess would make sense. Or I don't know if it was in the summer or not. But yeah, it's really strange because the boyfriend that I had at the time it's really weird because all of the people who are my good friends now, I became friends with pretty much a few months after my dad died. So it was like right around the same time, but none of them actually know my dad mm-hmm. or knew him.
Yeah, or realized that you were going through that in that time.
Yeah, I definitely didn't seem like that. I just so badly wanted to just be a 14-year-old girl chasing boys and caring about that stuff. And I recently was actually talking about, there was a point when I was supposed to go and see him, and I ended up calling him and canceling our plans so I could go watch Spy Kids with some friends from school, and that would have been the last time I saw him. So you know, it's just it took me a long time to forgive myself for that, because you don't know that at the time,
of course,
but you know, just realizing, like, yeah, it was it's okay that I wanted the boys and the friends to be my most important stuff going on in my life, but it was hard because I was going through a lot of other stuff, and still am trying to work through it, because it took, and that's, 18 years now, and I'm still working through a lot of the grieving process that I didn't do when I was 14.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I'm definitely right there with you. And yeah, I mean, that's where your priorities are when you're 14, and you don't know that it's going to be the last time. And I just appreciate you so much for sharing that, because I can see how hard that is for you. But, you know, that's the double-edged sword of being in that situation. And, you know, for those of us who have lost family members to addiction and alcoholism and overdose, it's not like that problem started that day that they died. It was something that was going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, when we can't find that connection with our family and that, you know, relationship that we need, because they're so wrapped up in what's going on with them that they can't give that to us, then we're going to seek that relationship from other people, like like-minded teenagers who are out there doing crazy things. Shifting gears, my other question was, so your first substance that you used was marijuana?
Yes.
And I just asked that because, of course, there's a lot of conversations around gateway drugs and things like that. And I believe that alcohol is the greatest gateway drug. But I think that a lot of what I'm going to say today is really around the theme that everyone is different. And heroin could be a gateway drug. I have to tell you this because I wasn't planning on talking about it, but I think it's pretty important and cool. I actually had the pleasure of doing an interview with the CDC last week. I did tell you about that, but they're seeking out input from opiate patients to help determine the new prescribing guidelines, which is something that they've been working on for a while. And I've actually seen it in, at the ground level, these changes in how doctors are prescribing opiates. But what something that came up in the conversation was they said, well, you know, usually I think the most common thing is people start with a prescription opiate and then they move on to harder drugs. And that's absolutely the most common thing that happens. Most people who use heroin started with a prescription drug. However, I had shot up heroin before I had abused prescription opiates. And I wasn't really into marijuana as a teenager. So I just like to draw attention to the fact that like these are common pathways, but that doesn't mean that they're the only pathway.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think of like with my experience that pot was the first drug that I was or substance that I was using. I didn't feel like that was the gateway into using alcohol. I did feel like I needed something stronger to alter my reality. But everyone around me was drinking a lot. And it was like, why am I not drinking? They're all having fun and they look like they're happy and I am not. So why don't I try that? But so was marijuana your first substance?
No, I actually alcohol was okay. My first substance. And yeah, I actually didn't like marijuana for a really long time. But I feel, and I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, that it was just so normalized growing up here in Carbondale with hippie parents that smoking weed was like a totally normal thing. And I honestly believe now that I wasn't interested. I mean, firstly, like I really didn't like the way it made me feel. But I think that I wasn't interested in it because it didn't really seem rebellious.
Yeah. I have always been drawn to marijuana. There's always been... Like, even before I started smoking it, I, you know, asked my mom about it. I just was always really curious about it. There was always something about it that I really was really drawn to. And now what I appreciate about it is that it doesn't alter me very much. And I can enjoy smoking some marijuana and not feel like I'm completely destroyed and can't do anything else. Because, I mean, even after one beer... it was hard for me to not just focus on having the next one and like get and do anything else. It was all about getting drunk and drinking. And pretty much after the point of starting to drink at 14 or 15 was when I really started drinking heavily. It was a struggle till about 25 of when I started kind of trying to look at maybe I do have a problem. And I had always kind of known that I maybe had a problem. But I didn't care. And that was always like, I don't care if I die the same way as my dad did. I said that on multiple occasions and really happy that I didn't.
Yeah, me too. But it definitely, I mean, it just becomes normalized. And that's, I grew up in a house with alcoholism as well. And it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with it when that's what your parent did. That seems totally normal. And in reality... that is the majority of what happens. And, you know, the fact that we can come to recovery in adulthood and break that cycle of violence and addiction is truly miraculous to me because we are set up for failure in a sense when we're raised in that environment because that's all we know.
Yeah. And I always and for a long time struggled with what I didn't do, you know, and like I said, that I was supposed to see him about a week before he did end up dying. And then the day that he did die, we were supposed to go down and help clean his house. And we were calling and we kept getting the busy signal. And my mom just said, you know, we'll just go and check in on him tomorrow and help him clean up tomorrow and whatever. And so my mom and sister and I drove down and my mom was the one who went in and found him and, of course, told my sister and I not to go in. Are you really not going to go into the house and see your dad and, like, make sure, like, not that it's not that I didn't believe or whatever, but you were in the house when your mom died. Should I
that's fine.
Warn you before I ask you something fine. Like that? But you were in the house, huh?
Well, yes, but I did not know that that had happened. So I was in the house, and, you know, my mother and my relationship was really never very good. And I had actually only been quasi-permanently living with her again for a couple of weeks when that happened. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, and again, I often say, like, nobody knows but God what really happened, because it's just hard, especially when people are using mind-altering substances, to know what really went down. But so I was in the house. I left for school at like 10 in the morning. I came to Glenwood, and I got a phone call that she had overdosed. And so she had been overdosed in the house while I was there, but I did not know that. Okay. And so my friend was living with me at the time, and he called me. I had probably only been in Glenwood for maybe an hour. And basically, my mom's boyfriend had woke him up to say she's unconscious. And so the reason I say only God knows is because who knows how long she was actually out for. Mm-hmm. I guess her boyfriend said that, you know, he flipped her over. He flipped her on her side in the middle of the night, that she was like vomiting and non-responsive, and he was like able to revive her in the middle of the night. But as I now know, heroin overdoses can kind of come and go. They don't really happen instantaneously. You can kind of slip in and out of them.
Okay.
I also had been told prior to that that she had overdosed before. But again, like, my mom and I did not have a good relationship. She was not willing to be open with me about what was going on, although I actually was trying to get her to be. And so I now know, and this makes sense, that she had probably overdosed at least once or twice before that incident. And when you have overdosed before, basically it actually increases the chances that you'll overdose again later, because it means that your brain has reduced its amount of opioid receptors. And so it's actually, you're at higher risk for overdosing if you've overdosed once before. Okay. So, yeah, it was a kind of a crazy situation. So I didn't actually see her until we went to the hospital, and they had revived her, which is, again, pretty crazy, because I think that at that point, like, we knew that it had been 25 minutes, which is, like, beyond the point of usually even trying to revive someone. Mm-hmm. But in reality, who knows how long it had been.
Yeah.
So she was revived, but she was comatose. And so she was comatose for a couple of months. And I actually really empathize with that story about your dad, because my mom was in the hospital here in Glenwood for probably a month before she was moved to, like, a brain trauma ward out in Thornton on the Front Range. And so she was actually in a coma for about 3 months before they had determined that her brain had basically collapsed in on itself from lack of oxygen and activity. And at that point, we decided to pull the plug. So I was there in the room when we pulled the plug. Mm. But I did not spend a lot of time in the hospital with my mom. And I beat myself up about that all the time, you know, like, if I could have been there with her, talking to her more, like, encouraging her and believing in her. But honestly, my belief the day that that happened was, like, I didn't think she was ever going to wake up. And I felt like this was my life, that this was what I was destined to experience, because I knew that it would make me strong. And it did. But I look back now, and it's like, how can you expect a 15-year-old girl to take on that kind of responsibility and to live in a hospital room with someone who they don't even really have a great relationship with, and that there's already a lot of guilt and shame around that relationship? And so I beat myself up for a long time, and I still do it, about not having spent more time with her in the hospital. But we have to cut ourselves some slack.
Yeah.
Because we were already living with all of the trauma from just having that parent with alcoholism or drug abuse.
Yeah. And I think being, you know, at that age, you know, you were 12. I was 14. You were a 12-year-old who was pretty much 14 or 16.
When we first met.
Yeah.
That, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I, at least in my experience, when I hit the teenager, I was like, oh, and I'm an adult now. And especially because we'd been through so much, mm-hmm. it was like, you can't, I've been through more than most 25-year-olds at that point than that. I just felt like you can't tell me what, you know, you can't tell me anything because I've been through it. I know. And so getting help was pretty much not really an option because I wasn't willing to admit that I needed help, you know. And yeah, my dad had been given 6 months, 2 years before he died.
Oh.
So we'd been really like, it was one of those things that I just was constantly wondering about and wondering when it was going to happen and expecting it to happen. And being a kid and knowing that your parent is going to die, it's like, it's so hard because, you know, there's that part of you that is somewhat mature that knows, like, once they're gone, they're out of this pain. And so there's that side of you that knows that, like, once they're dead, then they're free. And that's a relief for you. But you're still a little kid that wants their parent. And especially when you're that age that you don't want to admit mm-hmm. that you want your parent there. And, like, and that was what was really hard and what I think put a lot of strain on my mother and I's relationship was that I didn't want to admit that I needed her. And she didn't really know how to be there for me because first of all, you're not handed a handbook at when your kids right. are born, let alone how are you supposed to be there for your kid through something like that. And then puberty on top of that and all of the hormones. And it's just such a crazy cocktail of craziness and sadness and
and
drugs and access to drugs and alcohol.
I feel the same way about my mom. It's like she's released from that pain and it just comes back to that drug abuse and alcoholism is so often the symptom of the problem, not the problem itself.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's been documented plenty that kids in these situations often become like the parent role, whether it's to themselves or their siblings or their parents. They mm-hmm. feel like they're in charge. And there's actually, and this is my experience, there's actually data showing that the body has a sympathetic reaction to that too. And a lot of girls who are in these situations go through puberty really early. And it's really terrifying to think about because these are the girls like myself and possibly yourself as well, who are at the most risk for being sexually abused. And then now they have the body to mm-hmm. match and increase that risk.
Yeah.
But it took me until I was in my mid-20s to realize, wow, I actually could have benefited from having a strong parental figure in my life all those years, and especially as a teenager. And because you're going through so much and, yeah, to lose a parent and really it's very hard to find the people who can support you in that. And I think it's just nice because there is so much more attention drawn nowadays to trauma and to childhood neglect. And how can we help these families in a way that's actually going to help them?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that you say that's kind of when, yeah, it was about my mid-20s when I realized, like, oh. And we were talking about this the other day with teenagers, like, when we witness them now and they listen to to adults and we're like, you actually listen to the adults around you? Like, that was not my experience as a teenager. It was like anything any adult said was pretty much wrong and I was going to go complete opposite of it. There was a couple adults, teachers, actually Kate McGrath really mm-hmm. connected with me. I know that that's not always everybody's experience with their advisors at YAMPA, but I was really lucky to connect with my advisor, and she was somebody who was there for me and really made sure that I graduated from high school. She really, like, made that happen and helped me find credit where I needed it to make it work. So, Yeah. Shout out to Kate McGrath.
Yeah, and just shout out to Yampa. Like,
totally.
And the team there now, too. Like, they just do such amazing work for the community. And so I do not in any way condone what I'm about to say, but I often just wonder from my own perspective. I'm like, yeah, these kids know that they don't actually have to, quote unquote, go to school, right? Like, they tell you have to. You could, like, literally not. You could just walk away, because that's what we did. We just didn't go.
I would wake up at, like, 10 in the morning, wasted still from the night before, and be like, am I going to go to school today?
Nah. but we were, and I know that this happens in some of the alternative schools. They just have, like, rough years, and that was, I think, a really rough year. So double shout-outs, even though I actually didn't have a successful experience there. I know that a lot of the advisors there, like, I feel like if I had any other advisor, I would have been successful, because I love all those people that were working there, other than my advisor, to this day.
And I loved your advisor. I still love her.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think that she did. She helped a lot of people, and that's awesome. And, you know, and again, like, it's like you were saying, your mom didn't get a book on how to handle this. 15 years ago, they didn't know what to do with me. And that's fair, like, because I wasn't accepting the help. I wasn't listening to therapy. I wasn't getting anything out of drug court. And I wasn't going to school, you know, it was really hard. And I was also very intellectual. And so I didn't struggle with the academic aspect of school. I struggled with, like, social aspects of school. And I had struggled with the social aspects of school since kindergarten. I was being expelled, or not expelled, I was suspended multiple times in elementary school and middle school for violent behavior. And I think that, you know, yeah, of course, kids, like, sometimes they don't want to go to school because whatever, but, like, when you have a child that is consistently every single day not wanting to go to school and having these kind of social emotional problems that early on, that to me, you know, my mom just wasn't, she had her own behavioral health struggles. She wasn't able to do that. She was a single working mother. You know, what options does she have? She has to, I have to be in school, right? But I think now we have a lot more tools to be able to look at these situations and a lot more options for what we can provide for these students.
Yeah, and in this valley, even we are lucky enough to have so many different options for school. You know, like you said, I graduated from the Waldorf school. My mom could tell pretty early on that I did not do well in conventional school, and I was so lucky to have a parent who cared a lot about me getting an education and knew that, and you know, had the knowledge to know that not that the public school isn't the end all be all, that there are other options and that there's other ways to connect with education. And so I was lucky to have her, you know, she got me the scholarship, and my dad was still alive, and made it work. And it was really, I'm really grateful to it, because I was able to learn how to knit, and I was able to learn how to, you know, do all of these, you know, harmonize with singing and just things like that, that at the time it seemed like, why would I need to know this stuff? And now as I become an adult, like, it's all of the things that make me feel fulfilled. Like, I love knitting, and I love singing, and I love all of that. And so I was so lucky to have that. And then we also, of course, like we said, Yampa, and I went to Bridges as well. And we have a lot of options here in the Roaring Fork Valley. So
it goes back to the fact that there's not one thing that works for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. We need options. Yeah. And yeah, just because I had a bad experience with my advisor at Yampa, I mean, hundreds of other students probably had a great experience. I actually ended up graduating from what is now the Academy in Newcastle. It's like a Christian school. And they were the only people who really were willing to help. I mean, there were a lot of people who were trying, but they were the first ones to really work with me, because I also went to Glenwood High, and I went to, you know, a few different places before I found that. And then I also, you know, I definitely respect that there is, like, an important social component to school. And, like, I think now about, like, our friend who's daughters have just started school, and just, I mean, obviously pre-COVID, thinking about how much fun school can be when you're in kindergarten and first grade, and how there's a lot of really important social lessons. But then I was talking to some people here in Carbondale who are a part of, like, a homeschool movement, and, you know, they were, of course, like, they create their own social network, and they kind of actually made me realize, like, oh, yeah, it was obvious that I was not doing well socially from day one in school. And so there are important social lessons, but for people like me with serious emotional issues, it might not be the best atmosphere for that.
Yeah.
So, okay, so I want to kind of skip ahead. So we met in high school.
So that's why we have drug problems. That covers the ground as to why we like drugs.
Yeah, and we met in high school, and we pretty immediately, I really liked Kenna right away. Of course, it's difficult when you're a teenage girl to really make strong connections with females. Things get in the way.
Well, and our mutual friend, she was the one who kind of brought us together, and I think there might have been, and maybe this was my side, but a little bit of competition,
jealousy.
Maybe, like, that it's hard when, because you two had been friends for so long, your whole lives,
and
I
were
just kind of came
friend.
In, and I was her new friend, and we spent a lot of time together, and we were closer in age, and I don't know if there was any, like, weirdness, but I don't remember feeling as close to you then as I do now, and have, like, in the last couple, like, few years, I've been like, oh my God, I just need Maggie in my life.
No, definitely. And, like, I mean, looking back, there are a lot of things that created barriers for me having good relationships with females, but lots of reasons. But yeah, it's funny because it often was boys was the reason why you had a hard time. But in that situation, it was absolutely that I was jealous of your friendship with my other girlfriend. But I always really liked you.
Yeah. And there was one particular boy who
it
came
happens.
Between us two in particular, that there was one point at the height of your and I's dislike for each other, that there was just this one boy who stood in the way, and I'm just so happy that we've been able to work past all of that stupid, like, stuff that happens when you're teenagers and your priorities are mixed up.
Yes, and I will honestly admit that I have been the other woman many times. No judgments. It happens. I don't do that anymore. But again, like, I felt bad for, you know, when things were not good between us. And I think we're both thinking it was really just that one night, which we don't have to go into.
Yeah.
But, you know, just looking back and realizing, because you're not the only one that I lashed out at, and that was the year after my mom had passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was definitely, like, the hardest time in my life in general. And I didn't have a lot of good friends, and I was pushing everyone away who was still close to me. And I'm just so grateful because you're still my friend today, and I still have other friends who I treated very badly in the throes of my addiction. And now we can move past that and see that that was, like, a teenager trauma response, and that's totally normal. And so, yeah, we, you know, had our ups and downs. I think,
like, any good strong friendship,
right? And then, yeah, flash forward, I remember, so I moved away when I was 16 from the Valley for about 8 years and kind of lived all over. I remember coming back and visiting, and I remember when your dog was 2.5 years old and taking our dogs down to the dog park together and just blowing your mind with the weird stuff I was up to at that time.
Yeah, I just didn't know that people, like, still taxidermied animals or that I would know anybody who actually was into taxidermying animals. And before that experience, I thought it was the most horrifying thing ever. And now I can really appreciate it. So thank you for opening my eyes to the fact that taxiderming isn't that strange of a thing. But
yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. I was still a vegetarian when I started doing that. That was, it weirded me out that I was like, this is fun.
Yeah. Well, and you opened my eyes to a lot of different things because you were also in an open relationship, which I had never actually known anybody. And I had listened to Dan Savage, I think, maybe at that point. So I had an idea of open relationships, but I'd never actually known anyone. So cool stuff. Really cool stuff.
When I look back at that, and I was like, just your guys' reaction to what was happening in my relationship at that moment. And I was so proud. And then about 6 months later, I was pretty ashamed because it was like, yeah, well, it didn't work out. But I just think, you know, to me, I'm somebody who really, like, picks up where I've left off with people, even if it's been years. And so even just to talk to somebody, you know, I have friends who maybe I talk to them once a year, but that doesn't change, like, how much love I have for them and how connected I feel to them. We just live all over the place. And so that, to me, it's like, we still, even though it had been years, like, I wouldn't see a lot of people when I came back to the Valley from Santa Fe or wherever I was living at the time, because I had a lot of fear about seeing people who I had hurt in the past. And so being able to, you know, still have that friendship with you. And then flash forward, I moved back to the Valley in 2015. And I don't, not right away, but I pretty quickly got back involved with Katie and Kay. And I am, not to toot my own horn, but like a pretty avid Katie and Kay volunteer. I didn't make it to disc golf because it's been a busy summer, but you will usually see me.
Do not let anybody make you feel bad about that.
But you will usually see me at most Katie and Kay events. I'm very passionate about Katie and Kay because I've been here pretty much my whole life hanging out at the station. And so that was... I look back at, I was kind of like, why do I always want to go to every KDNK event? And I remembered that when I first started volunteering again, a huge driving force was, oh, maybe Ken is going to be there.
Oh.
And having a friend. And you were often when I first started volunteering again and having a friend who was in the station. And you know, it just really strengthened both my relationship with KDNK and my relationship with you to like have both of those things together and like just making it feel even more like home and somebody who I've always really liked and respected. And then I stopped drinking in February of 2019. So I've just got, 19 months sobriety right now. And I started hearing these rumors that other people I knew were also no longer drinking. And I think that our relationship and how important it has been, and I know we've talked about this, but definitely to me and my sobriety, I talk about this a lot with clients because people want to know, like, well, how did you get to where you are? You were shooting heroin, living on the street, you know, using your body in ways that are not healthy for so long. How are you where you're at now? Well, I once had a doctor tell me, if you want to quit smoking cigarettes, stop hanging out with smokers. Great advice. That's not super doable, right? But I mean, when you have to give up drinking, I mean, for me especially, and I feel like a lot of people, like, it is just such an integral part of your personality and who you are. And there's a lot of pride and ego associated with quitting drinking because it really does mean making the decision to live a different life. Nobody actively chooses to become an addict, but we have to actively make the decision to completely change our lives. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to Johann Hari today, and he was talking about the concept of natural recovery, that most people actually naturally recover. So most people who abuse substances are generally between the ages of 25 and 39. A lot of these studies were done in Canada and Britain and the US, and again, like, I'm just quoting the book. This is not end all be all stuff here. But I have heard that data before, and I always thought, well, yeah, because they die. If you know, like, if you're still 45 shooting up dope, you're probably gonna overdose and die. Or if you're, you know, an alcoholic in your 50s, like, medical problems start happening. And of course, there are outliers. And I do think that alcoholism is a little bit different than what I'm talking about right now. Mm-hmm. But as far as drug abuse goes, there really is this data showing that natural recovery usually happens for most people about 10 years after they first start using. And I really started my recovery process now when I look back at it at age 17, 18, when I was like, I'm not going to use cocaine anymore, because that was a big problem for me, more than heroin or marijuana or anything. Cocaine and alcohol were really my big issues, or really any stimulants, amphetamines. Kind of most poly drug abusers will use whatever they can get their hands on, and that was me, except for if it's like pot or psilocybin. I don't want nothing to do with that. I wanted to feel good. I wanted to party, right? And I did want to kind of feel like I was still in control a little bit. But that natural recovery model, I just see that very much in my life. And when people talk to me and want to know how I got sober, I see how much my relationships have influenced that. When I was 18, my partner, his father was a meth addict. He did not approve of me using stimulants. So for better or worse, he was kind of a jerk about it. But that really encouraged me to not be using cocaine anymore, right? And that was a good choice. And then now, my partner, who I've been with for 5.5 years, he's celebrating 10 years of sobriety in December. Yay! So with a pretty much 100% abstinent model most of the time. So mad props to him. But just living in an environment where I could feel safe that was pretty new, even at 25. That was a pretty new experience for me where I could really just feel like safe in my own space. And my partner is so supportive and such a great influence. He's super healthy and, you know, all of these things that I've always wanted to do but struggled to do, like workout routines, diets, you know, all, like just being, not diets, but just like healthy, clean living, mm-hmm. you know. And so when I did finally quit drinking, like I mean, even yesterday I was thinking about drinking. Like it's not that it just goes away, but I feel like it was a lot easier because I had progressively, like I had quit drinking liquor and then I was drinking maybe like once or twice a month, you know. And so I do still have addictive habits, absolutely. But it was easier for me to quit than I thought it would be because of my support systems. And so bringing it around full circle, sorry, I know that was kind of a tirade, but when I found out that you were sober, and then I would find out that so many other of my friends were sober. I found out that somebody I knew had been sober for 2 years and I had no idea. I found out that a friend of mine who's been struggling with heroin addiction for years was also like 1 month clean. And so, I mean, I had so many relationships just come out of the woodworks that were supportive. And, you know, part of it is really like, and this is so hard, but identifying toxic relationships in your life. And sometimes that's your family members and best friends and just accepting, you know, that this isn't healthy for me, or at least that like the way I'm interacting in this relationship right now is not healthy for me. But having your friendship, it's so crazy to me to look at, because it's like we had that Katie and Kay connection right away and we had known each other forever. And you were never somebody either, which is funny because I know that I did do some really bad stuff. I know that we had our problems, but you're not somebody who I was ever worried about not liking me.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, we had our bad stuff, but there was nothing ever that happened between the two of us that was like, I can't ever talk to you again. We were both in bad situations and started fights with each other.
Yeah. So. And I am very forgiving. Like I always tell, like, I don't judge what people do. It's just that if you are perpetually intoxicated, like I'm probably not going to hang out with you all the time, because I don't judge it. You're probably not making great decisions or treating people very well. Mm-hmm. And that's not always true. My ex he drank like crazy amounts of liquor and I never saw him get mean, you know? And that brings me to another interesting thing from Johann Hari, is he says from his studies that 90% of people who use substances recreationally do it responsibly, and only 10% develop addiction. And that one of the strongest predictive characteristics for addiction is childhood trauma. And then he goes on to explain why. I didn't need him to explain it. We have this pain that we do not know how to deal with because our parents could not teach us how, because our culture also could not teach us how. Mm-hmm. But what our culture does teach is that alcohol and marijuana are totally acceptable ways to cope with that pain. Mm-hmm. And I don't think marijuana really does it like alcohol does, because it just, yeah, altering your reality and altering your perceptions. But I'm sorry, going back to the thing. So Ken and I had this connection through Katie and Kay. And then all last summer we were playing, and fall, we were playing music together. And it was just so cool. And then I made the decision that I didn't want to go on tour this summer, last fall. And that was like, you guys had already made kind of the same decision. And so it's just really beautiful to me how serendipitous our relationship has been and how we have supported each other in such amazing ways without even meaning to.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really well said. So like I said, right around 25 was when I started going to therapy. Actually, it was the first time that, like, as an adult, because my mom had tried to get me to go to therapy as a kid, and it was, like, not about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of the stigma, like, I'm not crazy, I don't need it. So I seeked help out for myself on my own, and that was the first time. And he just kept drawing correlations and lines to the things that were going on in my life to alcohol. And I started kind of messing around with taking months off. And then I had like a good like 290 days sober at one point, and decided to start drinking again, thinking like, well, I went 290 days without drinking. I can get it under control. And of course, it did start out under control. And it took about 2 years till I got to the point again where I realized that it just really wasn't working. And of course, there was a lot of stuff with my relationship. I'm married, that led to the both of us getting sober. My therapist always encouraged me to go to AA for the support. And mm-hmm. I know in my heart from going through recovery that you need support in order to get it through. And whether that's AA or whatever other ways you can find your support, but you can't do it alone. And actually, from experience of trying to do it alone, not going to AA, having a partner who was still drinking, having everyone in my life still drinking, and literally being the only one trying not to, but not going to AA, didn't work. And it was really hard and just so painful. And I would have so many breakdowns of like, why am I the only one who's trying to do this? And that alone feeling is so... And that's what I think pushes all of us to start using, is mm-hmm. you feel so alone and you need to, you know, alter your reality and feel less alone. And so in sobriety, if you feel alone, it's not going to last. You know, you really need to find that support group. And we are so lucky to have each other. And you're right. When I found, and honestly, both my partner and I, when we both found out that you weren't drinking, that was huge for us. You know, having someone that you look up to and respect and know that, like, they're going through the same thing that you're going through is so impactful.
Yeah, and since then, like I said, more and more people who I know are going through that. And like I said, it's always kind of been my belief that it's like we kind of have to get sober or we will die or be in prison. But, you know, my partner and I actually talk about it all the time because we have a lot of friends, and just how important it is to us to not only have sober friends, but to have them be our old friends, because for a lot of reasons, like, that is really important to us. Because for me, it's like, I don't want to have to try to explain my whole self to new people. It's important to know people and be close with people who were there and saw it, even though we obviously were not aware of what was happening with each other as much as we'd like to think. That our friends are like interested in the same hobbies now, you know, and so that's just so important. And yeah, I think too, not only do we use alcohol, you know, to quell that loneliness, but alcohol and drugs are often a social thing. And I was actually reflecting about how I used to hang out at party houses just because I, you know, felt so alone at home. Uh-huh. And because there usually wasn't anyone at my house. And so I would just go to parties just because I just felt better having other people in the house, regardless of what was going on.
Yeah, totally.
And also on that note of needing support, I've been finding myself feeling a lot recently like I don't know who to talk to about my problems, because even though I feel I'm a super open person and I feel really close with my friends and my family and my partner, when I get really down, I don't really love to call those people. And I also don't always feel like they'll get where I'm coming from. And I had kind of an aha moment the other day. Maybe I should go to a meeting because they're going to know where I'm coming from. Mm. And, you know, it's just different. Like, yeah, of course, you and I are both in recovery, but it's just a different atmosphere. And I really think that that is one of the best things about therapy or potentially AA or NA groups, although in my experience here in the Valley, I do usually know lots of people there, is just that you have somebody who's not attached to the situation who can provide an unbiased perspective. Mm. And you don't have to be crazy to seek therapy. Anxiety and stress have become integral components of our culture. And in the context of COVID this past year, we know that that's getting worse. The data from the Colorado Health Institute tells us it is, but we can see it. We can see it in the stress and anxieties our teen population are having now in this generation. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with getting a little bit of support. It doesn't mean you're crazy. It doesn't mean you're a failure. We all need that. And especially right now, stuff's crazy. Mm-hmm. So just always putting it out there that MindSpring's health offices are open. And in Glenwood, we're taking walk-in and telehealth patients. So we'd love to hear from you and get you set up with somebody to chat with, even if it's just once. And so you can call any of our regional offices, and we also have our mental health support line where you can just call if you're having a little mental health needs, a little stressor, anxiety, or depression. That number is 1-877-519-6255. 7505. And in case of a psychiatric emergency, you can call our crisis hotline at 1-844-493-8255 or text TALK to 38255. And if you or somebody you know is struggling with substance abuse or addiction, or if you just have any questions about any of the topics we discussed here today, you can call me, Maggie Seldin, at 970-531-5060.
It's been really cool to go through this with you. And it's just been really cool to have you because, like I said, my partner is sober, but... And he offers support, you know, but that's if there's one thing that we keep learning about marriage and relationships is that your partner can't be all things to you. And having you in my life has really helped me so much. And so I really appreciate your friendship and I appreciate all that you do professionally with me as well.
Well, ditto. And yeah, that's why I thought this would be an important conversation for our show, because this is why we're here, right? This is what has encouraged us or inspired us to have this program, is just how successful we have been because of our relationship and wanting to share that and encourage others to share their stories and seek out whatever they feel they need to be the best version of themselves. And just to bring a little data into it, you know, that expectations of our partners to be the end all be all of all of our emotional needs is super, super new. The entire structure of American marriages is less than 100 years old and totally goes back to industrialization, and just everything in how we interact with each other has been changed by industrialization over the past 200 years. And yeah, we can't put all of our eggs in one basket. It's not fair, you know? And so to be able to have multiple outlets, like you've got your friends, you've got your partner, you've got your family, and you've got your therapist, and they all provide different things to you. And that's super important.
Yeah.
So I do have a little, it's not really a fun fact of the day, it's more of a fun quip for the day, but the fabulous Johan Hari says that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. Human connection. And when we look at our numbers for mental health needs and overdoses since quarantine began, I think that that is all the evidence we need to show that, you know, a lot of the substance use issues in our country are not based in the substances themselves entirely, but are strongly influenced by the cultural context and environment of their use. And to quote a silly little feel-good TV show that I'm really into for some reason called The Good Place, no one is beyond redemption. And to go back to Johan Hari, every person has the right to life.
Thank you for listening to Chemical World. You can find the extended version of this conversation at kdnk.org or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. Our next show will be airing on KDNK on November 9th at 4:30 p.m. And you can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Take care, everyone. And remember, you do not have to be sober
to keep your community clean.
We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. You know we are living in a chemical world. Chemical girl. Some boys sell weed, some boys smoke weed. I think they're okay. But if they give me stems and seeds, I have to walk away. He can beg and he can plead, but keep your drinks in sight. That's right, 'cause the boy with roof and all is always Mr. Right. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. Some boys snort coke, some boys shoot coke, that's all right with me. If they don't have clean works, then I have have to let them be. Some boys pop pills, some boys boof it, they will find a way. But only boys with proper hygiene get me high today. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. Some boys tell me that they're clean, but that's not enough for me. I always use my own works to avoid getting HIV. When somebody passes out, make sure to turn them on their side. And anytime you're shooting up, make sure Narcan's inside. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. If you have been using dope, there are lots of ways to get clean. Methadone and Suboxone can help you withdraw with no DTs. Drugs can keep your body well while we treat your mind with counseling. Suboxone can help opioid addicts and their families. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. Drugs may come and drugs may go, and that's all right, you see. Experience has made me rich, and now I can use safely. It might be beer, it might be dope, it may even be caffeine. But we all have a little something that keeps us on our feet. What's important is being safe and stopping the spread of disease. You do not have to be sober to keep your community clean. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical gender nondescript. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. You know we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl.